Welcome to the Encrypted Economy, where we look at the business of regulation and security for all things encrypted, digital assets, blockchain technology, privacy, and smart contracts. Hope you'll join us while we explore these forces that are shaping the economy. So this is Eric Hess with the Encrypted Economy. I'm really excited to have James Putra, Vice President of TraceStation Crypto, on the podcast today. I've had the opportunity to work with James a little bit on a corporate treasury product that he's structuring and was extremely impressed by his knowledge and invited him to come to the show, and he accepted. So I think it's going to be a great conversation. I've seen some of his other podcasts. They're really interesting. So James, thanks so much for joining the show.
I really appreciate it, Eric. Thank you for giving me the chance to talk with you and your audience. I'm looking forward to this a lot.
Yeah, me too. So why don't you share a little bit of your background with us?
Okay. Do you want the personal story now, or should we go into the just general background?
So for everybody listening, I already told James, we're going to do this personal story. So you can cut it up any way you want. He's jumping ahead. You can do it first. You can do it after. It's all good.
All right. I'll just do my normal bio, and then you can cut that in and surprise me. No. All right. I'll act surprised. So I've been in fintech now for, my entire career. Totally got lucky out of college. Joined a trading firm that free traders. I wanted to build an application. From there, we built a startup company. I sold it. And that's probably the worst thing you can do right out of college is have success as an entrepreneur, because then you think everything's easy. And so that one, did that, tried to do it again, blew that one up. And then I decided that I wanted to join more of the retail side to kind of help the retail audience. Went to E-Trade, built an FX trading business, came over to TraceStation, built a Japanese equities trading business, built an innovation lab for TraceStation, convinced them to go into crypto mining and try to kind of figure out how we can deal with these asset classes. And from 2014, ran a crypto mining operation at TraceStation. Around 2016, we got the green light to go build the trading operation. And from that point forward, we just started heads down trying to stand up the overall crypto trading business. It's been an intense and insane ride since we got into crypto.
Yeah, I think for anybody, you got to have a strong gut for that too. So now that personal experience that I cut you off on.
Oh, no problem. So I think probably the single thing that shaped me the most is my family is from all over the world. My father's from Malaysia. My mom's from England. I was born in England. I grew up in Chicago. My parents had separated when I was young. And so I grew up with four sets of grandparents. And having this sort of really interesting worldview where I had family influence from Malaysia, from England, from the US, it really kind of opened my eyes about how to look at the world. And I was super fortunate. You know, you hear these horror stories about stepfamilies. I had awesome stepfamilies. They were super cool with me and my brother. And we had, we just always had amazing Christmases and Easters and just great, great family events. And now even today, whenever I travel, it's usually to go see some family. So it's super cool. I have along the way of kind of those expanding family, I have picked up an extra sister, an extra brother. So I know a lot of people have these really nice family trees that look like a pine tree. Mine looks like the ficus tree that's got the roots, like massive roots. So it's super cool. And it's definitely the single thing that shaped me the most in my kind of perception and how I interact with the world.
Awesome. And have you traveled back to Malaysia?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Kuala Lumpur.
I get there about every other year. Yeah. Kuala Lumpur. Probably every other year I get over there. My brother lives there. My dad lives there. So it's nice to get back. And I love the curry. I can't get enough.
Yeah, no, it's great. The curry is great. And I actually spent some time in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, and I did some trekking in the highlands there. It's great. I love the country. It's a great place. So great story. And then it brings back memories for me. But well, we're not there to reminisce on this. Well, the people on the podcast will be like, hold on, was this a travel show or was this Eric Hess reminiscing on his trip to Malaysia? So right now, what are the challenges that TradeStation, or at least your role, is trying to solve for right now? Or what problems or issues or marketplace need?
So there's a big shift happening. If you look at the kind of baseline across the US and even the world, the interest rates are ultra low. Bonds are getting hammered. The typical balanced portfolio model of 60-40 bonds equity split is just it's not holding true anymore. It worked for a while. And so there's this shift happening where individuals, even institutions, are having to change their perspective and look for different types of asset classes that are beyond just the traditional bond and equity market. And you combine that with inflation and some of the kind of really interesting things that are going on macro, folks are starting to look for new types of asset classes. And in the backdrop to all that, we have a lot of exponential technology going on. It's the first time in history that we have as many core technologies and pieces of our life that are going through network adoption effects, and they're massively starting to scale. And so from everything, from the way we do finance, the way we do healthcare, the way we do cars, I think Raul Paul talks a lot about this. Every car in the world is about to be obsolete in the next 10 years. We're going to have to replace them all. So I'm going off on a tangent. What we see is
assuming we can get semiconductor chips for them.
Yes. Yeah. And copper and all of that stuff. So, yeah. So kind of in that crazy backdrop of the entire world is changing very quickly, we see that the way that people invest is also changing. We do a great job as financial services to lock everybody up into a specific bank or a specific broker dealer, and your money is stuck there. So like my wealth is maybe my retirement account at one institution, my trading account at another, my house in another place, and it's not very portable. And as a global citizen, someone that lives around the world, I need to be able to access my value in kind of a global space. And we see that that's one of the big shifts that's happening. And when we look at our business, we say we are a participant in that, locking you up into this silo of capital. And we want to extend our business to allow access to this more, let's say, global pool of capital. And cryptocurrency for us is one of those gateways. We see our role as we have a group of people that trade traditional markets and we have access to crypto markets. So we provide that unique familiar experience for you to go from Apple one day to Bitcoin the next day. And that was what we initially set out to do, was how do we open up access to that world of digital assets and cryptocurrencies in a way that people could be familiar with and could rely on. We did that. And what we're seeing now is it's really important to expand access to more people. It's still not easy or very comfortable for many people to get involved with. We do see a lot of the retail folks have found their way into the asset class. We're starting to try to cultivate some of the systems and some of the infrastructure, some of the regulation to expand beyond just retail. And you do see some companies that have come in, Tesla, MicroStrategy, Square. That's just the start. We think as the participation comes in and the market cap increases, we're likely to see more participants come in. And so we still are fairly laser focused on how do we mature that space for ourselves and our clients, and how do we add more utility in there? So the utility part is really interesting for us and the area we're trying to solve for now. So today I've got Apple stock. It's not really portable, not really super easy to deal with. I could transfer between brokers, but I can't use it anywhere else. Cryptocurrency introduces an asset that is a little bit different in the sense that if you wanted to, you could actually pay somebody with your Bitcoin. Tax implications aside, like there are assets like stable coins that may be more interesting for you to work with that are opening up access to these type of neobank setups where it's not a traditional brick and mortar bank. It's a type of service. Like for us, we offer essentially a lot of the same services a bank can, but we can offer those through crypto. So you may have a crypto account, and how do I give you the ability to maybe earn interest on that? So that was the first part for us, is you've got an asset. How do I let you earn interest on that asset? What are the different ways we do that? Are we going to make you get into loans? Are we going to make you do like CD lockups? Are we just going to pay you interest like a traditional savings account? That was the first area that we kind of dove into. And then once you have that, people now start to think, well, I would like to maybe spend that, or I would like to maybe bill, provide an invoice for that. And so we're really focused around providing that utility around cryptocurrency that doesn't live so much in the equities world. So besides just having the trading side of it and the speculation, crypto opens up a lot of possibilities around utility and how you can interact with this kind of crypto financial system. I don't think we're going to ever, as TradeStation, get super attached to DeFi. I think our role really is to sit on that one foot in the regulated markets, one foot in the crypto markets, and provide a trusted way to get into the space. And we'll leave the more DeFi long tail risk things to the real crypto specialized firms. And I think that's really where we fit well. If I were to sum it all up, we see the problem as making it easy for people to get into the space and allowing them to be able to live and use the assets that are in the space that they can't do with other asset classes.
Right, right. And certainly, like, you know, when you talk about being able to get interest on your assets, you know, it cuts the other way and you wonder where these interest rates come from. But I just heard even recently somebody was wanted to borrow money to buy a house, and they had Bitcoin and they needed to get it done quickly. And he was stunned at how easy it was to collateralize his Bitcoin and basically get the money to buy a house like almost instantly. So now he's got Bitcoin as collateral for his house. But you know, if he's a long-term believer in Bitcoin, you know, he's going to benefit from that appreciation. And he got the loan instantly and he got pretty good rates. So pretty amazing when you think about what that potentially means and the ability to generate returns for people who are lending on Bitcoin, you know, the ease of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. That there's a lot of folks that, well, there's kind of two reasons the entire market exists is people have a lot of crypto assets and they want to unlock capital without taking the tax hit. And the other side of it is that access to banking for crypto firms is not really prevalent yet. And so they have to go and they want to fund their operations. Where do they go? They're going to raise capital and sell their company or maybe go into the lend borrow markets. And so it's really created this kind of unique space where the individuals have the same problem as the entities and kind of work together to solve it.
Yeah, who wants to sell it for a tax hit if you can basically get interest on it, right? So
yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's probably why Tesla delisted the purchasing, because I think that from their tax perspective and operations of liquidating is probably pretty hard to pay for a car that way.
So it's, you know, we're taping this on May the 14th. And because of that, it's like almost impossible for us to do this podcast without talking about the fire hose of news that's happened within the last 48 hours, much less so yesterday, pretty much more so the day before. Of course, I'm talking about, you know, both Vitalik, what he did with regards to SHIB and all these coins that he was gifted. I guess maybe either I can give the background or you can give the background, but it was really sort of, you know, earth-shattering when it happened. I mean, I was watching it on Etherscan, all these different movements of Ethereum to, you know, out of his accounts and into other accounts for like some of these meme tokens that he was gifted. And it was like watching a show. Like I felt like just, you know, getting a big bag of popcorn and just like, I just found it so incredibly enjoyable. And then of course, following that, we had Elon Musk, you know, with him saying, you know what I said about Bitcoin? Well, you know, I'm not really excited about this whole green thing, which was, you know, I think it was in many ways, it was a good move because, you know, there are environmental concerns, but it was sort of like an about face for the market. And then people were recovering from that. And then, of course, Binance had their little announcement, possibly overblown to some extent, about their being investigated by a DOJ. I mean, these investigations, I think, you know, I think Binance is getting used to the regulators by now. So it shouldn't be like, oh my God, Binance is being, you know, investigated by regulators. Like, yeah, sure, of course. But, you know, from your side, and I don't know whether the intro for SHIB, you know, the everybody knows Dogecoin was the, you know, this coin that was promoted by Elon, and then all these sort of like meme coins sort of like were trying to cash in on that whole rise to fame. So they did the Shiba Inu, they did another one called Elon, they did yet some other ones. And for some reason, they thought it was a really great idea. They said, hey, we're just going to like send half of it to like Vitalik, because he's, you know, it's going to look good. Like, you know, we want some of that, some of his vibe, and people will buy it. I mean, I think that's what it basically was. It was a branding exercise. And people were saying, oh, you know, he'll just burn it or he'll do something or he's a responsible guy. But Vitalik like wants nothing to do with it, like on some level. He's like, I don't really want to be the patsy, you know. And as Shiba Inu, SHIB and Elon, those tokens rose in value, he actually accumulated quite a bit of wealth, like billions. Like, it's crazy. And, you know, even though you have to sell it, it's not, may not be worth billions when you sell it. So basically what he did, and I know I'm jumping into it, but I want your reaction, is basically what he did is he moved it. He started moving it, but he moved, I think the most, he moved it to a bunch of charitable organizations. One of the most significant was India's COVID relief fund that was being managed by Polygon, another Ethereum project or venture. So, but basically when he did this, the market was collapsing. Everybody was reeling like, oh my God, he just like totally pulled everything out. So, and then the Elon Musk, I'll let you talk about, James. That's less of a backstory, but yeah. How about your reaction to the last 48 hours?
It's exciting. I'm definitely not as versed on the Vitalik piece. I know just enough to be dangerous, but I can only imagine the tax hit that you could expect by getting these airdrop tokens. I don't know the tax treatment at the moment, but it's a lot of money. I can totally understand his desire to not be the kind of marketing face. And if he held on to them, that would be definitely a show of support. I think it's great, as you point out, that he donated the assets to charity. Hopefully that they can get to the right hands and somebody could use them. I think on the Elon side, it's interesting because I'm not sure, more than it was more of a marketing play to accept Bitcoin for Teslas, I think.
Initially,
and I'm not sure it really had a whole lot to do with environmental concerns. That provides a lot of cover. Maybe it did, but if you accept Bitcoin for a car and you still need to run your operations, you need to liquidate that coin, take the tax hit, and then all, which is what capital gains for them probably going to be 40% instead of a sales tax. So it's definitely a different animal. And then you need your operations team to be able to liquidate those coins. And my guess is there wasn't enough scale for them, and the taxes just didn't make it worth it for them to be able to liquidate. It'd be interesting if they start taking stable coins. That would be really kind of interesting for me to see if they move that direction. When you have an asset like Bitcoin and you have tax treatment with capital gains, it's not the most optimal way to purchase things. But I definitely borrow against it because that can reduce your tax bill and you just have an interest rate there.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. It's what I thought was interesting is the market perceived it as Elon basically backing away a little bit from Bitcoin. You know, the environmental narrative, I mean, is kind of an odd one because people focus on the fact that, there was a prominent Cambridge professor that came out and said that to do a transaction in Bitcoin is like a freight liner, you know, floating around the world. And I was just like, A transaction is not the same as mining Bitcoin. You can transact all day. Like, are you kidding me? And he's like, the guy's like, you know, he's prominent. I mean, I just couldn't get over it. I'm like, you know, that little detail is kind of significant. Every time you trade Bitcoin, it's not like some freight line around the world is taking off to deliver, a boatload of lumber to the other side of the world. So.
No, I wouldn't be surprised if we hear an announcement in the next quarter that they purchase more Bitcoin. That wouldn't be surprising to me at all.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? I don't know. It's. I think it's built some of the case for some of the green alternatives, you know. And it's also interesting, and something else I wanted to ask you about, like how does so Elon was sort of seen as this sort of Bitcoin emissary in some ways. There's obviously others. Michael Saylor would take issue to say that Elon's bigger than he is when it comes to Bitcoin. That guy, you know, did a serious dice roll, and there's plenty of others. You know, how does that impact, you know, because you have a product that focuses on corporate treasury, and it's not really exclusively based on Bitcoin, and you'll explain it. I mean, I think there's a stablecoin component to it, and Bitcoin is, you know, there's a component, but how does, like, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Bitcoin as a corporate treasury asset, which I don't know is quite as compelling as some of the things with stablecoin, but we'll put that to the side. How does like what Elon said sort of impacts that narrative?
So what Elon was, so kind of the actions he took about removing it as a payment mechanism and the statements around the green energy, I don't think it impacts the narrative of companies wanting to use this as a corporate treasury asset. If you're considering Bitcoin as a corporate treasury asset, you're worried about your cash or treasuries or other assets in relation to how well they're maintaining their value. You have a shareholder obligation to return as much value to your shareholders as possible. I would argue that losing 15% a year on your cash, your devaluation, is probably not as important. Well, probably offsets the green concerns, at least initially. Maybe if you, I probably should unpack that a little bit. Since 2020, the M2 money supply in the US has increased 26%, which means 26% of all dollars in circulation were printed since February 2020. If you go since 2008, the G4 central banks have increased their balance sheet 618%, which averages out to be like 13% a year on an annualized basis. And that equates to a devaluation of fiat currency around 15%. Now, some of it, that's definitely not that linear, but that averages out. If you think about that, that makes any cash assets you have or treasury assets really not that interesting. Even if it's fixed income, it's just not keeping pace with the scale at which we're expanding balance sheets. And if you, it's interesting, there's some great graphs. If you take the S&P 500 across the Fed balance sheet, it looks flat relative to the central bank balance sheet. So when you think about, does it impact the use case of Tesla, which is an early adopter, commenting on the green energy? I think that it would. However, there are more pressing concerns for a lot of the corporate treasurers at the moment, and returning shareholder value, preserving their purchasing power are most likely in the top of mind, at least in the top concerns for them. And that's where they're likely focused. And whether it's Bitcoin or other types of assets or gold, the market, whether it's treasurers, individual investors, even institutions, are looking for alternatives to get into outside differently than bonds or differently than cash or fixed income. And there's that rotation happening. So I think Michael Saylor talks about it as he's sitting on a melting ice cube. He's built all this value and it just is melting up from underneath him. So that pressing issue about what do you do with your corporate treasury still exists independent of if there's a concern of the green impact of Bitcoin.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that I've contemplated is the green impact of Bitcoin, while it's going to be hard because, you know, basically the consensus, it's something that I believe that is going to be addressed eventually, because I don't think the miners are particularly loving how much they have to spend on mining and being chased, you know, all over the world because of the ESG initiatives. And it's costly. So it gets to a point where I think a lot of people say, you know, okay, that worked well for the Bitcoin that we have now, but as we're, you know, going to start to hit the maximum number, maybe the cost of the mining is too much and we need to think of some other model that isn't as energy intensive. So, you know, and obviously, you know, at some point you have to think more of almost like a, I don't know if proof of stake is necessarily it. And some people might say, well, I don't know how you get to that in Bitcoin, but there needs to be like there probably ultimately needs to be a shift in the model over time for it to be sustainable. And I don't mean even environmentally sustainable. I mean sustainable as an asset, because you need to engage the validators. And if the mining is just too hard, or it's just controlled by, you know, people who can go through all the energy gyrations, then that's not really the best long term. But that's changeable, just hard, but changeable.
It's interesting though, because the, you know, when you think about Bitcoin as an energy consumption, kind of the immediate picture comes to mind, like it's a miner connected to a coal burning plant, right? And just polluting like crazy. And in some cases, that's probably accurate, but by and large, it's not that accurate, because the miners are looking for very cheap electricity, which tends to be next to a dam, next to a hydroelectric plant, or places where there are surplus energy. And even today, take away Bitcoin, we have pockets of energy that's just wasted because we can't use it. And so that's where you find that cheaper, abundant energy, and the mining operations tend to gravitate to those areas. I'm not sure that it's entirely necessary to change the model. I think what's happening in Europe is a great example of how hard they're pushing to become the green leaders, and they're doing a great job. If you want to invest in green energy, Europe is your place. From all the different technology, the platforms, and they're just leading the charge. And I think the rest of the world will start to adopt some of those technologies. And if it keeps going at this pace, abundant energy, clean abundant energy, could really take over. And it won't matter as much that Bitcoin has a large energy consumption, because they'll just have enough. We're not going to be absorbing the energy of a little town and jacking up the rates on grandma or polluting like crazy.
Yeah. And Nick Carter has done a lot of writing on this, and he's a thought leader when it comes to like this whole energy consumption debate. And then there's also some interesting companies, like, for example, Caruso Energy. Jay Slockmiller has spoken on a number of podcasts, and he's associated with a private equity fund I'm associated with. But basically what they do is they take portable data centers and they locate in jurisdictions where there's flaring. Because basically the nature of extracting oil or natural gas from the earth, it's never a perfect balance. And that's why when you see oil flares or fires when you're mining, they're burning the excess of what they don't want. But that also is a pollutant. So what these guys did is just brilliant. They basically did portable data centers tapping into those flares and consume that energy as opposed to piping it into the atmosphere. So basically they were actually getting paid to do this because there were caps that the states are putting on the amount that they could, amount of pollutants they could create. So by them coming in, they were actually saving money to the oil producers and the natural gas, producers as well. And that's like a perfect story. Or like another perfect story is, and I think this was in the Stone Ridge letter, is like, think about a dam where it didn't make sense to basically draw that energy because of you had to transport it, right? But Bitcoin, it doesn't matter. Like you can stick it in the middle of a jungle and you can create it there and you can tap into the dam. It doesn't really matter. You're not piping it anywhere. So that's like a perfect example where it could actually facilitate the type of infrastructure which could draw that energy and actually fund it and possibly then be used to make it more usable for other purposes. So again, there's still a lot that has to be worked out. I'm sure there's counters on each side, but it's not like it's a completely one-way narrative. I agree with you on that. So before we go back to corporate treasury, speak to me of the flippening.
Oh, between Ethereum and Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's like, it's so funny in the crypto space. We have all these like words, they sound like so profound, the flippening, oracles, DAOs. I mean, it feels like we're rolling back a few centuries in our narrative. But anyway, speak to me of the flippening.
So it's an interesting, I think it's, whether or not it actually happens is difficult to say. I think right now Ethereum is having a massive growth. It has a lot more use cases available than Bitcoin, which is great. We're seeing this become a nice platform, whether it's to build, initially with smart contracts, but folks are starting to build really interesting applications, lending borrow applications, new types of exchanges. So this big explosion in NFTs. So from a network adoption, this one, Ethereum seems to have a really solid base to work from, and it's captured a lot of attention and a lot of interest. It's also driven the fees up like crazy. But that, to me, when you look at it, that is becoming a really solid, I think, solid platform to be able to work from. Does it overtake Bitcoin in terms of market cap? Probably. I think that it's inevitable, but they're different use cases. Bitcoin is really meant or seems to be evolving towards this type of collateral, maybe inflation protection hedge, where Ethereum is being used to develop other types of applications. Maybe Bitcoin gets there, but they seem to be really diverging in terms of what they're going to be fundamentally used for. I think that this year, for sure, Ethereum is likely to outperform on the upside. Does it sustain? Hard to say, but there's a lot of very, very smart people in both Bitcoin and Ethereum, but a lot of really, really smart people building value on top of the network, building businesses, building infrastructure. I don't know long term, but I would say that we're likely this year to see definitely an increase in the market cap. I don't know when is it projected to flip. I don't have that visibility, but I definitely think you'll see it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. So back to the corporate treasury product. So let's talk about we talked a little bit about the position of a corporate treasurer and having to start to, your via Michael Saylor's analogy of sitting on a melting ice cube, because if you're just sitting on cash or you're sitting on something that isn't keeping up with the inflationary pressures on the dollar, then that value that you're holding on your as an asset is eroding. And it almost begs the question, whether it's crypto or something else, you have to somehow do something to maintain that value. Is this resonating with the corporate treasurers that you're talking to? Is it a discussion or are we still in the classroom?
It's a lot of classroom. We're still having a lot of just general discussions and education. What tends to happen is folks come in and they think, oh, this is crypto, it's Bitcoin, it's risky. And there's a lot of reputation risk or perceived like nobody got fired holding treasuries, but there's a fear that you get fired over holding Bitcoin. So we tend to spend a lot of our efforts in educating, outreach, sharing information. What we are seeing is quite interesting is we will engage with folks that personally hold Bitcoin, but are not yet ready to take the leap for the company. And so we find that a lot. Now, those are pretty interesting conversations because they recognize the need. Like we talk to them and they will say, you don't have to say anymore. I get it. I understand. I did this personally. I just don't have that leap yet that I can take it for, whether it's my fund or my corporation. Now, we estimate it's likely at a 6 to 8 month sales cycle for somebody to really, we spend time with them, we warm them up and really help them feel comfortable. And hopefully or ideally they work with us, but there's a couple other firms that they can work with that will also help them. So we tend to make sure that they get our perspective and other perspectives in the industry so that it's they get a well-rounded view of the space. But definitely classroom, we are getting firms that are very, I think the stepping stone for them is much easier to stable coins than it is to Bitcoin. And when you start talking to a treasurer or a CEO and you say, well, you have dollars that are sitting in your bank and they're earning 20, 30 basis points, and you can put those dollars with TradeStation and you can earn 6% if you're holding it in a dollar stable coin. There's no volatility, it's 1-to-1. And we explain the various risks to them and that makes sense. That's an easy step. It's I put in $100, I know I'm gonna get $100 back. When we start to grow them into Bitcoin, that's a harder sell. Then there's a lot more conversations and questions around what is it, what's the volatility, what are my accounting challenges? So it's more than just educating on Bitcoin. We end up having to engage and educate their treasury, their accountants, their executives, their risk teams, so that the entire team knows what it is and they can all buy into it. There's absolutely an age divide that's very clear as we talk to the different folks of who's more open to the idea and who's very resistant to the idea.
So like Charlie Munger's not a good target for you, right? Berkshire Hathaway?
Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. But it's okay. We don't need everybody.
I 100% agree with that. Like, you know, the whole Berkshire Hathaway debate, the point to Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger and to say, hey, they don't believe in it. It's like, of course they don't. Like they've spent their whole career, like their lifetime, not even having to be exposed to anything like that. You can't even expect them to say, oh, Warren Buffett missed it. No, he's death. You know, like, so I agree with you. There is an age divide. There is an experiential divide. And somebody who's like, past his prime, less likely to want to take a risk and go to something they don't know or have the ability to get enough for what they bring to the market and what they know. How can they bring that to something that they don't know as well? And it's very risky from a reputational perspective in their eyes. So how do you get how do corporate treasurers wrap their head around the risk management of this? That's a hard question.
Yeah. So we will provide a variety of research and resources for them to help understand. You know, we'll kind of nail down this about 6 or 7 things that a corporate treasurer tend to think about independent of crypto, inflation, security, a variety of those. And we will give them some research and we'll show them, hey, these are your concerns. We recognize that those are your kind of general things to think about. Here is the case for crypto and whether it's Bitcoin or stablecoins, these are the things and how it equates into those specific items. So in the case of dollar-based assets, you have something that needs to be earning at least the treasury rate. So how are you going to go from cash to treasuries? That's probably the right step if you're sitting in cash. And then we can walk you towards an openness around stable coins at a higher interest rate. I would say almost always what happens is the first call, there's an excitement, then it goes quiet. Then there's another call that says, my kids talked to me about this or my friends talked to me about this. So then there's more information. Then there's some follow-ups. It's really what sells here is not the asset or the protection. It's that the corporate treasurer know that they can pick up the phone and call someone and go, I don't understand what's happening. Can you tell me? And that's really the important part in the beginning where folks are trying to get used to this.
Right, right. Because they also have to answer questions to their board. And if they don't have somebody, if they can't get somebody to sort of explain it to them, you know, when they're getting questioned, then that's not good. Talk to me a little bit about the various considerations or categories of considerations that institutional holders of the asset need to contemplate or should be contemplating when they're looking at a corporate treasury solution?
So the big one really is safety of assets for them. As a corporate, anybody in a corporation, whether CEO, board member, you need to be able to know where your assets are and that you have access to them. Typically, we would look to like a JP Morgan and say, okay, it's JP Morgan. They're likely to be there in the future, so I'm okay with that. Put my cash there. In crypto, it's a little bit different. There's not a JP Morgan yet. There's not a well-known bank that I can deposit my crypto. It's changing for sure. I mean, there's a lot of folks working to fix that. And my guess is in the next 12 months, that dynamic will be very different, where you'll have a couple of larger banks where you can easily just go and deposit your crypto. There's some use cases now where you can, but it's not not as easy for you and I to go and open up an account and just deposit Bitcoin yet.
No.
That's coming. So can I trust my security funds and the custody side? So as you start looking in, this is where most folks get stuck, because they say, well, where is the bank or who's going to hold the assets? And I've never heard of BitGo. I've never heard of Anchorage. Who is, like, so you go on this list and it's firms that they're just not familiar with. You get the TradeStation. You're like, okay, I understand TradeStation. You guys have broker dealer. You've been doing this for a long time. That makes sense. But I'm still used to holding cash in the bank. I'm not used to putting it into a brokerage account. So there's a hurdle there. So definitely trying to get comfortable with where your funds are. Can you access them when you need them? That's the other aspect of this. On top of that, it's going to be, what type of volatility or yield do I have on these assets? When you think about cash, it's going to be your basic interest rate, your treasuries. When they look at Bitcoin, there's a volatility concern. If I give you $1 million, am I going to be able to take back $1 million? Most of these guys are not looking at the idea that, well, I'll give you $1 million, I'm going to take 10. They're not traders.
Right.
They have a certain amount of money. They want to put it in and they want to know they can take it back when they get that chance. So kind of that, say, volatility risk. We talked about the kind of reputation concerns about, can I actually explain this in the education gap? So those are tend to be the three main challenges that we have to coach folks along. But it's sort of a really interesting cliff. You spend a lot of time at the uncertain part, and then there's a toe dip and this crazy all in.
Right.
Right. Water and then a head first dive.
Yeah. And so do they, like, when they start to look at like BitGo, do the information security officers get involved, or is it more like, just tell me about BitGo's structure and what do they do at a high level? Like, how deep does a corporate treasurer go, and how deep should they go? I mean, listen, BitGo, we both know BitGo has done, you know, amazing things in terms of security. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of very secure custodians out there, despite the fact that you hear about these exchanges being hacked that just simply don't have the right security. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't institutions like BitGo, like Anchorage, like Prime Trust. You know, we had Scott Purcell, CEO of Prime Trust, on the podcast not too long ago. But you know, these entities, they take security very seriously, and they're not going to be experiencing the same issues that some of these other, you know, central exchanges that aren't regulated or don't put a premium on that are experiencing.
So the challenge there really is, like, today the treasurer, even his intern, could just go and open up a bank account. Right? That's not a lot of technical knowledge required. And then there's a clean path for them to accept their assets and deposit them into the bank. When you start thinking about crypto and you get into BitGo, the treasurer, or the, it's not even the treasurer at this point, but the company needs to think through, are they going to maintain control over those wallets? Are they going to take on the responsibility of dealing with their keys, having to do the transfers in and out, and then how do they convert that into cash when they need it? I think Galaxy is probably the closest at this point to offering a really, like, custodial solution alongside of the investment bank style, so to speak, where you could have that segregated custody, you could have the liquidity source, you could have the size and the volume, and you don't have to worry about handling the assets yourself. We try to take the TradeStation, we do that for our customers, which is, you don't have to hold them and manage them yourself. We'll take care of that headache for you. And you have a liquidity source. Now, we're built on top of a trading platform. Some folks are comfortable with that. Some folks are not comfortable. They look for a more traditional bank. And those are decisions that the different treasurers will have to make, you know, how much do they want hands-on? Let's say mostly hands-off would be open up a TradeStation account, you deposit your cash and you have liquidity and custody. If you want something super hands-on, they're going to be looking at BitGo or others that you had mentioned. And then they have to build up their operational processes all about how to manage it. So I think your original question, which I deviated from, was what do they actually look for in terms of due diligence? They don't know the right questions to ask yet. And that's the challenge. When folks come to us, we try to encourage them on the questions like, what are the security procedures that you have? What is the redundancy, the access to the assets? How are the keys protected? BitGo is the only one that has SOC 1, SOC 2. Those type of things help. How reputable are they in the space? And that's part of that education piece, that it's not clear exactly what to ask. And so you have to try to help to get to those questions.
Right. Well, that's important, like to help them understand, hey, here are the questions you should be thinking about, and here are we answering them. And excellent. And so in terms of the TradeStation strategy, I know we talked about how the model that you're using for the corporate treasury is one of depositing as stable coins for interest. How does Bitcoin factor into that product, or does it? I think it does. You could sort of explain the connection.
So we have at TradeStation, we have the basic infrastructure for custody and liquidity of assets. When you look at the stable coins, in terms of stable coins, you can buy and sell them on our platform. It's one-to-one. I'll convert them. It's a dollar for every stable coin, no commission. That is, if you hold a balance of stable coin, you start earning interest immediately. And how does the other crypto assets factor in? The other ones are just further out on the risk curve. So if you want to hold $100,000 or a million in stable coin, you can do that. If you want to split it up and say, I would like some volatility risk, I'll put some in Bitcoin and some in stablecoin, you have that capabilities to do that. That's sort of where we stop. We're not in the business of recommending portfolio allocations. We're more talking to you about the tools and saying, here are the types, here's the properties. You need to figure out what's right for your business in terms of the mix. But a treasurer or an executive can come in and look at this and balance their portfolio with all the assets that are offered at TradeStation. If it's stablecoins, they'll learn interest. If it's crypto, other crypto, they'll also learn interest. But they can also span into the sister companies. And if they would decide that they wanted to hold treasuries or fixed income or futures or equities, they can do that with our sister company securities, TradeStation Securities. So we kind of think of it all as you package up these assets for the companies to engage with. It's capability that they could use, whether they do or not is, you know, entirely up to them. It's like the digital camera. You've got 500 settings and all you do is point and click. So that's pretty much what we see. Most people gravitate to USDC, if not Bitcoin, and USDC is some combination.
Yeah. I mean, certainly for you, I think it's better if you can get all that business, because if you're holding fixed income and you're holding, like you're getting the returns on the stable coin and you're bringing up your account view and you're looking at, oh, this is what I'm making on treasuries. Oh, this is what I'm making on lending stable coins. I think over time, you're going to see more of it dropping into the stable coin bucket. So it gives them a ramp to sort of, as they get comfortable with it, to sort of increase their allocation without having to necessarily jump between accounts. So
it's important. I think I look at my account, I see 0% on cash and 6% on stablecoin. Okay, we put as much as I can in the stablecoin. Yeah, you see some interesting use cases though. Like on the trading side, people, when they go away for the weekend, they dump their cash into stablecoin, earn 6% over the weekend, and bring it back in for trading on Monday.
Not a bad idea. I think it's increasingly, you know, there's definitely something that I think not only institutions, but even retail investors need to think about, like, hey, I'm holding all this cash, but I'm sitting on a melting ice cube. Stable coins they're stable and you can get interest on them. What makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, stable coins.
Even at 6%, you're doing a lot better than the 20 basis points in the bank, and you're definitely earning more than the fixed income products.
100%. Yeah. So excellent. Well, you know, this was a great discussion. Appreciate having you on the show. Before actually I move on to the question of where can the people reach you, anything else that I didn't ask that maybe we should have touched on?
I think we covered a lot. The risks of Dogecoin, maybe we should ask.
Okay. I'm down with that. Let's roll it out a little bit with Dogecoin. I mean, we hit on SHIB, but we didn't actually go into the Doge. So What are your thoughts on the rise of Dogecoin?
So I would have to say, like, full disclosure, I accidentally owned Dogecoin. I did mining and I had like $150 worth of Dogecoin, which is now some obnoxious amount. I think that there's two risks that we need to be careful of with Dogecoin. One, this has become such a speculative asset. And typically in crypto, you're going to find on Bitcoin, for example, people make money, they invest in the network, they pay for development, they participate into the ecosystem. The assets like Dogecoin that have become highly speculative are more, I'm just making money and riding it up. And there's not yet been a lot of reinvestment into making the network secure, into evolving the use cases and really dealing with that underlying infrastructure. One risk that I'm pretty concerned about is it doesn't cost much to take over the Dogecoin network. You can do it with a computer and $5 million and you can start doing replay attacks. And my concern is that there's so much speculation in this asset and there's a lot of risks that the speculators aren't really paying attention to. And there's not a large community trying to fix those risks, that this could be quite a spectacular explosion. I think the risk for the overall crypto industry is it's a lot of retail people. And if the retail people get hosed on an asset like Doge or anything else, it's going to cause a very vicious, quick regulation in place that might be an overshoot that's not necessary, but we just weren't responsible as investors in playing with these assets.
No, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, with Dogecoin, I'll also confess. So when it was like 5.5 cents, I thought it was interesting. And I actually was building a thesis around it because every time somebody dismissed it, I said, something doesn't make sense. Like when everybody was dismissing it, it almost was like what do they call that? A negative indicator or a positive? Yes. I don't know.
A contrarian.
A contrarian, right? And so initially, you know, it seemed sort of very intriguing from that sense. Like it was being dismissed, but yet it did have these network effects and it was hard to deny. But then once you start to see it like dropping behind, you know, not too far behind, well, I mean, it is far behind Ethereum, but on the overall cap, it's like one of the top, you know, it's one of the top in market cap of all crypto, and it's based on a meme. And to your point, Doge could be the poster child for why regulation needs to come in and make sure retail investors don't hurt themselves, right? I was at dinner the other night, and somebody who asked, you know, she's like, should I invest in Dogecoin? She had like, you know, $500 in her account or something. And I was just like joking around. She's like, I know somebody who made $11,000 in it. And I'm like, well, you know, there's probably something to be said about investing in a token that doesn't really have fundamentals when it's at the all-time high, right? Mm. But, you know, I said, why don't you put $100 and go to bed and see if it drops in the morning, and maybe you buy more if it drops and just buy a little bit as you drop. I mean, it was only $100, but you know, I went along with it. But it was just interesting how like the perception was everybody's like, there's a FOMO, right? I don't want to miss out on Dogecoin. But on some level, I mean, you know, do you really think it's going to keep just going and going and going? At some point, the further up it goes, but to your point, the more of a risk it creates for the whole ecosystem, right? This is not really what the crypto market should be about. Ethereum has fundamentals. You could argue about the valuation, whatever. We could do that all day long. You know, Bitcoin has fundamentals. You know, again, same thing. But Dogecoin is truly based. It doesn't have the underlying network. It doesn't have that resiliency. It doesn't necessarily have the scalability. What it does have is sort of a friendliness. But yeah, no, I actually have the same fear. Like I actually, while I was a fan of it at 5.5 cents, I'm really not a fan of it now, not because I don't, it's irrespective of whether it rises. It's the risk it creates to the overall ecosystem as a whole. So I'm with you there. So you touched a vein.
Well, also, I think Coinbase, they were getting hammered with customers leaving and they announced they're going to hold it. That's a pretty significant amount of customers that could just click buy on that coin. If Reddit mob gets behind, it could get scary on that.
So you're not a buyer of Dogecoin?
No, I'm definitely a seller of Dogecoin. I think it's fun to play with, but I don't have. Now, I will tell you one thing, though. This is what the people in traditional finance say about crypto, and the people that are older in crypto say about the new stuff in crypto. So I could be totally wrong. This could be the next thing, and I have no idea. I don't think so, but I find myself making the same argument that everyone says about Bitcoin and Bitcoin says about other assets. So I'm definitely not a buyer. I have a bunch of sell happy to find a way to sell it.
Right. And again, to that point, you get all these retail people who are inexperienced and they jump in the Doge and then Doge, you know, crashes. That's a very large group of people who might just be sort of turned off from crypto investing. And that's probably a mistake. There's just, you know, there's a lot of noise in the market. That's for sure. So anyway, so it was great having you on the show. If people want to, you know more about you or know more about TradeStation, where can they find you?
Definitely can check us out on www.tradestationcrypto.com. We'd love to have you guys stop by, take a look at what we're doing, and maybe have a chance to talk with you. If you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at James R. Putra, and happy to connect with you and have a conversation.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, James. It was great having you on.
Yeah, thank you so much for hosting me. I really appreciate the time, and it's always a pleasure talking with you, Eric. Let's do this again.
So this is Eric Hess with a update to the podcast that we did with James Putra. You might be sticking it at the beginning. On the podcast, we talked a lot about corporate treasuries and how corporate treasuries should be thinking about potentially adding, you know, whether Bitcoin, stablecoin to their portfolio and the types of products that could help them. And stablecoin in the sense of getting yield from them and lending and finding the most conservative path for participating and getting the additional yield without all the downside risk. And so we taped that on May the 14th, and then lo and behold, we wake up to a week of a fire hose of news. You have Elon saying Tesla's, you know, maybe I'm going to sell everything in Tesla. And then, of course, coming out with diamond hands, of course, I'm not. You have China banning Bitcoin for like, what, the fourth or fifth time. And then even this morning, we're recording this on the 21st, China kind of coming out again and saying, now we're doing miners too. It's like, okay, we get it. You hate it because you're doing a CBDC and, you know, this is a risk. So you're going to take every chance you can to kick us in the gut. You've got Reuters spreading terrible news that, like, you know, complete ban and everything else, you know, doom and gloom. And then of course you have a lot of leverage positions sort of expiring, which, you know, there was a lot of leverage in the market and a lot of those positions were blown out. So you've had a massive correction in the last week. And so I said, James, we gotta update the podcast because, you know, how can we talk about risk without talking about everything that happened? So James, with everything that's happened, how does this impact the case for the corporate treasurer?
This is a great question. If you're on the fence, it definitely didn't help. It probably skewed you back onto the other side of the fence of let's just wait and see. If you've already crossed over and you're looking for some type of alternative asset, I don't know that it's going to dissuade you too much. The corporate treasurers are not trading a position. They're not really dealing with intraday. They're looking much longer term. You know, they're worried about what's going to happen in the next 1 to 5 years. This intraday volatility doesn't help for the treasurers to make the case, but they're already looking for something that has some better, say, inflation protection than you would find on cash or something else. Regarding the stablecoins, that's an interesting one because that serves as sort of that first step footing for treasurers that are looking for yield better than the dollars. And that story was really overshadowed specifically with Tether, where they came out that I think it's what 60 something percent of their balance sheet is corporate debt. So it's really more of a credit tracking stablecoin than actually a dollar-based tracking stablecoin. That should be really interesting for treasurers to look at as making sure they're aware of what they're actually getting into on the stablecoin side. And a lot of different products will say that they have these treasury reserves, and it's important that you find out who the auditors are, what's actually behind them, and you do your due diligence like you do in any kind of investment. I mean, I would argue that if a treasurer is going to get into an ETF, they do diligence on who the lawyers are, who the auditors are, what that product is beyond just, oh, I think it's listed on NASDAQ, it's okay.
Right.
So there's a level of diligence that has to happen. The challenge is that I think that the treasurers and some of the, let's say, the more forward-thinking folks would be able to understand is trying to relate that back to the rest of the board who just sees China ban, who just sees Bitcoin implosion and trying to really hold that steady explanation of what's going on and really why the underlying need for an alternative hasn't changed. Maybe the solution that you are choosing might have a little bit different characteristics now, or you might think differently about it. But overall, 1 week of volatility, 1 week of deleveraging shouldn't really sway the folks that have already made the decision market to go. We were, what, February 4th was a MicroStrategies event, 8,000 plus companies. They said 6 months. So for us to really see what that shakes out, we're talking starting Q3 earnings calls, we should start to hear about this. That's for folks that really ran fast to get in. Right. So it doesn't make it easier to do the education, the argument, but I don't think it's the ones that are really going forward are not too dissuaded from this, at least the ones we're talking to.
Right. And I suppose a case could also be made is that maybe it changes the nature of the exposure or how much exposure, but it really shouldn't change if you had a bias towards sort of towing in, then maybe it makes you a little hesitant about how much you tow in, but it's going to be difficult to catch up, at a certain point if you're not starting to kind of start to understand and start to experiment with it. And again, in the stablecoin context, the yields are there and DeFi is driving those yields much higher than you can get on the dollar, which is, obviously going to have an inflationary problem. So anyway, so James and I figured we had to come back on and sort of like we couldn't publish this podcast without, addressing the elephant in the room. So James, thanks so much for coming back on and giving some insight on how Treasury should be looking at it in light of the last week's volatility.
Thanks again for having me.
All right. Take care.